Welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum this evening. The Independent Policy Forum is a regular series of lectures, debates, and seminars that we hold here at our conference center in Oakland or elsewhere in the Bay Area. And our program this evening is an event which is increasingly in the news, fortunately. It's entitled Patriot Acts 1 and 2, The New Assault on Liberty. The event is also featuring, as many of you also know, two important books that we strongly recommend that each of you get. The first one is called Enemy Aliens by David Cole, and the second one is a book called Terrorism and Tyranny by James Bamford. I'm sorry.
That's the first time I've had that confusion.
Yeah, James Bovard, sorry. We had Jim Bamford speak here last June.
People have done with those French names.
I know that. For those of you who are new to the Independent Institute, hopefully you picked up a packet when you registered. You'll find information in there about our many publications and events and media projects. We invite you to become a member of the Independent Institute and receive new books and essentially receive information about the many activities that we're involved in. Our website is independent.org. You'll find an enormous amount of material on that, which is updated on a regular basis. And we also invite you to receive our weekly email newsletter, which is called The Lighthouse. To chair this evening's program, I want to introduce our senior fellow, Dr. Ivan Eland, who's director of a new program we started here earlier this year called the Center on Peace and Liberty. He received his PhD in history from the University of Michigan and has been director of defense policy studies at the Cato Institute. He's been principal defense analyst at the Congressional Budget Office and evaluator in charge for national security and intelligence of the U.S. General Accounting Office and investigator for the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He is editor of the book Putting Defense Back in U.S. Defense Policy and many other studies. On our website, if you go down and scroll on the home page, you'll find information about the center. And Ivan, we'll introduce our speakers and give you more introduced information about the center's program.
Thanks, David. Thanks, everyone, for coming tonight. We've got a great panel of speakers. I'm going to make a few brief remarks, and then I'll turn it over to our panel of experts. I'd first like to thank Bridget O'Neill, who organized the forum and recruited the excellent panel of speakers, and I'd like to thank the other staff members of the Independent Institute. Everyone here at the Independent Institute helps us out with these forums, and they do a great job. So I just wanted to thank everybody for helping out here. And I'd also like to put the our experts are going to go in depth into these restrictions on civil liberty since 9/11. But I thought I might put the whole topic in a broader context. Oftentimes we focus on what the government does when it restricts civil liberties, but few people ask, you know, there's a causal chain there, and few people go back in the causal chain to see what leads to all this. And usually when we have restrictions of civil liberties, there's a perceived security threat, whether it's crime or whether it's terrorism, which is, of course, a crime, but we think of it a bit differently. But nonetheless, there's some sort of a threat there. But what's often lost, I think, is that many times government action has caused the problem in the first place. And of course, who gets the most resources when there's a crisis? The government gets more resources to fix the problem. So there's kind of an endless cycle of where the government contributes heavily towards creating the crisis, then demands more power to solve the crisis, makes the crisis worse, and then demands even more power. And so we get into this endless cycle. And I think the war on drugs is sort of an example, a non-terrorist example of this, where the war on drugs raises the price of drugs. It causes people to go out and commit crimes to get money to buy the drugs. And then, of course, we have the crime wave, which leads to the restrictions of the civil liberties. So, and in the area of terrorism, which we're going to talk about tonight, or I guess many people are going to talk about, what we see is 9/11 did not happen in a vacuum. Very frankly, heavy-handed U.S. Meddling around the world has caused the blowback of catastrophic terrorism. Bin Laden has said that he attacks the United States because we had troops in Saudi Arabia, in the Muslim holy sites. We have supported the Saudi government, which he thinks is corrupt, etc. So this is an example, I think, of where the U.S. government tends to serve its own interests and the vested interests that support the government rather than the people it's supposed to serve, and that's, of course, the American public. After the 9/11 crisis, the executive branch used the crisis to go on a war footing, grab more executive power, and, of course, they then exacerbated the problem by going after an unrelated country, by invading Iraq, which it seemed to me if they were protecting the people of the United States, they would try to minimize terrorism rather than maximize it. But of course, we've seen a rash of terrorist incidents in every place from Morocco to Saudi Arabia to Indonesia after this, and it's probably only a matter of time before we have another terrorist attack here. So, of course, this will probably lead to calls for more government power. Of course, if we'll go on another war footing, if this one hasn't expired by then. And so, in short, overseas intervention and wars are ultimately one cause down the chain of restrictions on civil liberties. And, of course, we never really ask ourselves whether the last round of government restrictions prevented the terrorist attacks. They passed an act called the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act under the Clinton administration in response to the first World Trade Center bombing and the Oklahoma City bombing. But of course, the legislation that they passed, oftentimes after a crisis like this, the Congress has to pretend to the public like it's doing something about the problem. And so, of course, the legislation that they passed wouldn't have prevented the attacks, and of course, it didn't prevent the 9/11 attacks. So we never go back and ask ourselves whether these restrictions on civil liberties have been effective in the past, and perhaps we ought to start doing that. Murdering people, destroying property, causing injury was illegal long before these specialized terrorist laws came along, and do we really need special draconian terrorism legislation? That's the question. I think the government probably had adequate investigative and prosecutorial avenues available to fight terrorism even before 9/11, and we've heard, of course, that the bureaucracies didn't really cooperate in the intelligence area. And effectively, what we're doing whenever a crisis occurs is they increase the budget for these agencies, whereas we ought to ask them what were they doing and were they competent in the first place. So I think. And many times we get this increased government power, the powers aren't restricted to terrorism. They're broader. In fact, now we have the Homeland Security Department is now investigating child porn. Well, child porn is a problem, but I'm not sure it should be done at the federal level, and I'm not sure that it's a national security threat. Certainly, it's a social problem, and certainly, something needs to be done about it, but. Is it really a security issue? So these agencies expand their powers and use crises to do that. So I think the erosion of civil liberties gives the terrorists another victory. Of course, their first victory is blowing up the buildings or knocking them down with aircraft and killing all the people. But the second goal, and Bin Laden is a very shrewd operator, he's actually said that one of his goals is to change U.S. society. Well, he's done that. And if we have further attacks, he may do it again. So I think some of these techniques aren't even advocated by some of the FBI agents and law enforcement people. Racial and ethnic profiling, for instance, many of the agents say ensnare innocent people, crowd out more effective law enforcement techniques, and of course, they burn bridges with ethnic communities that could provide intelligence for you against the terrorists. So I'm just trying to put this in a bit broader perspective tonight. I've written an article, which is available free of charge upstairs for Mediterranean Quarterly, which some... Oh, it's in the packet. Oh, okay. You don't have to go anywhere to get it. It's called Bush's Wars and the State of Civil Liberties. And in that article, I sort of summarize the provisions of the Patriot Act 1, the executive actions since 9/11 that have also restricted civil liberties, and what we're loosely calling Patriot Act II, that is further erosion of civil liberties. So I think I'll stop there and... Okay. If it's not in your packet, if the article is not in the packet, it's upstairs. So anyway, I'll proceed now to introduce the speakers. Our first speaker is David Cole. He's a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, and he's the legal affairs correspondent for The Nation and a columnist for The Legal Times and a commentator on National Public Radio's program All Things Considered. He's also the author of the books Enemy Aliens and Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. Let me just hold that book up once more here. I know David already held it up, but this is the book that you all should get. And our second speaker is Margaret Russell. Margaret Russell is a professor of law at Santa Clara University. She serves on the ACLU National Board and is the past chair of the ACLU of Northern California. She also was the director of public interest programs and the assistant dean of student affairs at Stanford. Our third speaker is James Bovard, and he is also author of many books. And of course, he's the author of Terrorism and Tyranny, Trampling Freedom, Justice, and Peace to Rid the World of Evil. He's also a policy advisor at the Future Freedom Foundation, and he's the author of 5 books in total and a past recipient of the Free Press Association's Book of the Year Award for his book, Lost Rights. So I think we'll just go in order there, and I won't further interrupt the proceedings. So go ahead, David.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. And I was told that we should be brief so that we can hear from you and have participatory discussion. And I thought that was a good entreaty, particularly since one of the first lessons I learned in the wake of 9/11 is that when you speak on the subject of civil liberties in the war on terrorism, you should speak briefly. I learned that lesson when I read in December of 2001 that a college in Sacramento had invited a newspaper editor to come speak at the college's mid-year commencement ceremony, and she decided to speak on the subject of civil liberties and the war on terrorism, and she was booed and hissed off the stage. And the New York Times did a story about it, and being the paragon of objective journalism, they went out and interviewed the students, and one of the students explained the reason that she was booed and hissed off the stage was not the content of what she said, but the fact that she went on for too long. So the New York Times, being at least at that time the paragon of investigative journalism, went out and got the videotape and taped it and found that she spoke for 8 minutes and that the boos started at 4. Now, I'm going to trust that you're a much better behaved crowd here, and you didn't have to come here because your parents paid for your college education. So hopefully I can go a little longer than 4. But I am going to talk about Patriot 1 and Patriot 2, but I want to put it in a little broader context as well. And I want to go back for just a second to a prior period of time in the United States where we similarly faced a threat of terrorism. And that is 1919. The communists had taken over in Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc countries. There was mass unemployment in the United States. 1,600 strikes in that year alone across the country involving 4 million workers. Several of them turned violent. This was punctuated by a series of terrorist bombings. First, mail bombs delivered to people like Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, to the Attorney General, to several senators and mayors. And then a suicide bomber who blew himself up and blew the front off of the private residence of Attorney General Palmer in Washington, D.C. We responded, the government responded to that series of terrorist attacks in a way that I think is illustrative with respect to the way we've responded to the 9/11 attack. They did not go out and capture the terrorists. In fact, the terrorists were never found and brought to justice. Instead, what they did was use immigration law to target foreign nationals and to sweep up thousands in coordinated raids around the country known to this day as the Palmer Raids. And they were charged not with terrorism, but with technical immigration violations and with guilt by association. And writing about that after the fact, Lewis Post said, he was the acting Secretary of Labor at the time, he actually was an incredibly brave man who stepped in and overturned over 1,500 of the deportation orders on various grounds and was called up on impeachment charges for having done so. Writing about that period, he said, the delirium caused by the bombings turned in the direction of a deportation crusade with all the spontaneity of water seeking out the course of least resistance. With all the spontaneity of water seeking out the course of least resistance. And to me, we have similarly, since September 11th, sought out the course of least resistance. We have talked about the need to recalibrate the balance between liberty and security. And I think that's a legitimate set of questions to ask. But for the most part, we have not been asked to give up our liberties in the name of a promise of greater security. Rather, what the government has said is we will give up their liberties, they being foreign nationals and especially Arab and Muslim foreign nationals, for your security. That's an easy way for a politician to strike the balance because, of course, foreign nationals don't vote. And when the government has done that, for the most part, we have stood silently by. When, by contrast, the government has asked us, the citizenry, to sacrifice our liberties in the name of national security, we have been much less willing to do so. So we have adopted essentially a double standard here. We're willing to give up others' rights, but not our own. I want to just lay out the case for this double standard, and it really begins with the detention campaign, the preventive detention campaign undertaken by John Ashcroft after September 11th. Some of you may remember it. He made a speech to the Conference of Mayors in New York in October of 2001, looked around the room, saw that Lloyd Benson was nowhere to be seen, and then compared himself favorably to Robert Kennedy. And he said, just like Robert Kennedy would arrest a mobster for spitting on the sidewalk, so too I, John Ashcroft, will use every law in my power, including immigration law, to lock up suspected terrorists, keep them off the street, and prevent the next terrorist attack from occurring. Well, what do we know about that terrorist, that preventive detention, anti-terrorism campaign? Since September 11th, the government has locked up over 5,000 foreign nationals in anti-terrorism initiatives, over 5,000. Of those 5,000, how many have been charged as being a member of Al-Qaeda? Zero. How many have been charged with being involved in September 11th? Zero. The only person charged with Al-Qaeda and September 11th is Zacharias Moussaoui, and he was, of course, picked up before September 11th and before the preventive detention campaign began. How many of those people have been charged with any terrorist crime? Three. And of those three, two were acquitted of the terrorist charges. One person convicted of conspiring to provide material support to some unspecified terrorist act in the unspecified future. That's it for 5,000 people detained. Yet many of these people were detained initially without any charges, locked up in the United States. You ask, why am I locked up? There are no charges. They were locked up in secret. Your wife sees that you haven't come home. She calls the FBI, the INS, the local police. They tell her they've got no record. You're sitting in jail behind them, but they tell her they've got no record because the arrests were secret and are secret to this day. Many of these people were eventually charged with some sort of immigration violation. All of those were tried in secret. Their immigration hearings were closed to the public, to the press, to members of the family. Some of these individuals admitted that they violated immigration law and said, I'll leave. And usually that's the end of a case because the only purpose of an immigration case is to deport people who are unlawfully here. But when the purpose is not to enforce the immigration law, but to use the immigration law as a pretext to lock people up that we lack objective evidence of probable cause of criminal activity, It's a problem when they say they're willing to leave. So we resolve that problem by adopting the hold until cleared policy, where people were after their immigration cases were resolved and they were told by the judge they could leave, the FBI wouldn't let them leave until the FBI convinced itself that they were innocent of any connection to terrorism. Virtually everybody in that group of 5,000 was found to have no connection to terrorism whatsoever. Not only not charged, but to have no connection. Now, if John Ashcroft had gone out and locked up 5,000 U.S. citizens after 9/11, and at the end of the day could come up with one conviction for any kind of crime related to terrorism, I think he'd be out of a job. But because these were foreign nationals, we have largely stood silently by. Guantanamo. The government's argument with respect to the people on Guantanamo is that the government can hold them there because they are foreign nationals. Because they're foreign nationals and not on U.S. soil, therefore they have no rights, therefore we can hold them indefinitely, incommunicado, without charges, without hearings, without access to lawyers or their family for the rest of their lives. For the rest of their lives, because they're foreign nationals. The military tribunal order, which says that we can try those people and any other foreign national who is accused of terrorism in a trial where you can be convicted and executed on the basis of evidence that you cannot see and that your chosen lawyer cannot see. That military tribunal order applies only to non-citizens. Why? There's no legal reason that it applies only to non-citizens. The Supreme Court has upheld the use of military tribunals for citizens as well as non-citizens as recently as World War II. The reason was political. It's easier to apply it only to non-citizens because then we can say, as Dick Cheney did the day the order was issued, when a foreigner comes here and attacks us, he doesn't deserve the same rights and guarantees that an American citizen does. Message, Americans, your rights aren't at stake here. We're taking their rights. Ethnic profiling. The government's defense of ethnic profiling is interesting. They say, and I quote Mike Chertoff, the head of the criminal division in the Justice Department, testifying in Congress, we are adamantly opposed to ethnic profiling. We do not engage in ethnic profiling. Next sentence. What we do is target foreign nationals based on country of passport. And then you look at what countries of passport, and they are Arab and Muslim countries. The defense, again, we're targeting foreign nationals, which brings me to Patriot 1 and Patriot 2. Patriot 1 and Patriot 2 are problematic laws. Patriot 1, when it was enacted 6 weeks after September 11th, received only one negative vote in the Senate. The vote was 98-1. I don't think Strom Thurmond voted. The only person who voted against it was Russ Feingold from Wisconsin. It has since become a dirty word in a wide spectrum of circles. Last week, Al Gore said we should repeal it. Newt Gingrich said we should too. Bob Barr, Dick Armey, and every Democratic presidential candidate have criticized the Patriot Act. In the Democratic presidential candidate speeches, their criticism of the Patriot Act gets the biggest applause line. We have turned around. I mean, this country was no one was against the Patriot Act when it was enacted. Today, many, many people are against it in both parties. And what are the reasons that we're against it? We're against it because of the surveillance provisions, the library provision, the sneak and peek provision, the authority to do searches and wiretaps without probable cause of criminal conduct. In other words, we're against it because of the provisions that might affect us. You don't hear about the other provisions, what I consider much worse provisions in the Patriot Act, provisions that allow the government to keep foreign nationals out of this country based purely on their speech, reviving ideological exclusion, provisions that allow the government to deport foreign nationals based on their innocent associations with groups that John Ashcroft doesn't like, and that give John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, the power to detain foreign nationals without charges and without making a showing to a court that they're dangerous or a threat to national security. Those are the most damning provisions of the Patriot Act, and yet we don't hear about them because they don't affect us. The proposals that would affect us, we have said we're not interested in. National ID card, we'd all have to carry one, so it was killed by Congress in the Homeland Security Act. Operation TIPS, where the government was going to go out and recruit 11 million citizens to spy on the rest of us and then give report on the suspicious activities to the Justice Department, killed by Congress in the Homeland Security Act. Total information awareness, where we were going to create this computer program and sit John Poindexter down in front of it so that he could monitor all of the computer accessible data about all of us all of the time to look for patterns of terrorist activity, killed. We didn't want the government looking at our records, much less the Pentagon, much less John Poindexter doing that. And so it was killed by Congress just last month. So when we're asked to sacrifice our rights, we say, wait a minute, we're not so ready to do so. But when we're asked to sacrifice others' rights, we are quite willing to do so. Now let me just close by suggesting that that is an ill-advised strategy. Why? Because what you see when you look at history is that this is always the form that measures incursions first take in national security crises. The government always targets foreign nationals first, always makes the argument that the threat is foreign, that they don't deserve the same rights that we do, that Americans are different, and that Americans' rights are not at stake. And yet, history shows that what is done to foreign nationals is a precursor for what will be done to citizens. Take the Palmer raids, the rounding up of thousands of foreign nationals using immigration law. The architect of the Palmer raids was not Attorney General Palmer. It was a young man just out of law school, George Washington Law School, whose first job in the Justice Department was regulating enemy aliens during World War I. His second job was heading up the Radical Alien Division of the Justice Department. He planned this entire campaign. His name was J. Edgar Hoover. And I argue in my book, first jobs can be habit forming. He spent the rest of his career heading up the FBI, seeking to extend these measures to citizens. And in the McCarthy era, he succeeded, and guilt by association became the watchword. And tens of thousands of Americans went to jail, lost their jobs, were blacklisted because of their political affiliations. Every significant form of political repression that has been directed against citizens started out as an anti-alien measure. Finally, it's wrong. It's wrong to target foreign nationals in this way. Foreign nationals are entitled to the same basic human rights that we are. The rights of the Bill of Rights are not limited to citizens. They extend to persons, to people, to the accused. Everyone has the same interest in not being locked up arbitrarily. So let me close with a quote from a Jewish philosopher, Hermann Cohen, and this quote I use as the epigraph for my book. The alien was to be protected, not because he was a member of one's family, clan, or religious community, but because he was a human being. In the alien, therefore, man discovered the idea of humanity. To me, the greatest challenge that we face in the wake of 9/11 is whether we can reclaim that idea of humanity. Thank you.